G'day, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Peter Mason.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yes, you are listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And as usual, we've got a couple of hot topics to discuss. And we also have a really excellent guest for you today. And we'll tell you a little bit about that after I let you know that I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
Well, our special guest on this podcast is the former Australian cricket wicketkeeper, Greg Dyer. Now, the reason we're talking to Mr. Dyer is because, obviously, we saw Steve Smith accused of cheating in India. And, of course, Greg Dyer suffered the same ignominy during his career. And he was never allowed to speak about the accusations at the time. He was not allowed to attend a press conference. So it shows how times have changed. But also with the depression in sport after careers are over. Greg Dyer, in the brilliant book by Malcolm Knox about the wicketkeepers in Australian cricket, said that, you know, it was a real shock when it came to an end, his career, because, you know, he was out of cricket within pretty much a very short period of time. I think it was within a year of losing his place in the Australian team, he was gone from Sheffield Shield cricket as well, and it was all over. So it's interesting just to hear his thoughts on how you cope with that situation and how life starts again once your sporting career is over. But John, I believe you're going to start us off with a topic today.
Well, it appears as though there's going to be another group of players that are going to have coping with their careers cut short for reasons outside of their being, and that's Super Rugby players. We've heard in the last few hours that the Super Rugby will indeed be cut. There are going to be two teams leaving the South African Conference and one team leaving the Australian Conference, of course. It hasn't been confirmed which team, but it has been whittled down to two, the Melbourne Rebels and the Western Force. Of course, we're in Perth, so we feel something of a kinship with the Western Force. And I've got to say, it's a terrible, terrible decision that they've made, Sansa. It was a terrible, terrible decision to expand the competition even more globally, when essentially it is a domestic competition that's played between three countries. And it'll be the death of rugby in this state if the Force are to go.
Well, I wrote a piece when they did announce that they were expanding it to Super 18, saying that they should learn the lessons of the European Rugby Championships, where they actually cut that back. After the game went professional after 1995, they realised that there was just too much rugby being played, and what it had done, it had weakened the international product. So what they did was they then cut back their leagues. So it seemed bizarre that Super Rugby, which was one of the toughest competitions in the world, then looked to expand. And the big thing, of course, though, John, has been the fact that every single club, I think only the Crusaders broke even. All of the other clubs, even in New Zealand, in South Africa and in Australia, have lost money since it's gone to Super 18. So money is the driving force here. Also the cumbersomeness of the competition. Nobody really knows what the hell's going on, who's playing who. It's now just become too confusing with the Argentinians in there, Japan in there, and all of that. Now, the big thing you said there was two teams going from South Africa. Now, yeah, the South African Rugby Union haven't even met on this. They're due to meet in this week to discuss that. And then you have to have all of the franchises meeting and agreeing to it. Now, if they decide, you know what, we don't want to go down this path, and they pull out, then Super Rugby, as proposed by Sansar, could go in the bin. Which I think, and I've written a piece on the website, notthefootyshow.com, that may open the door if the Force are thrown out, because who knows, maybe the Force could go and play in a South African competition, because it's only a jump across the Indian Ocean. We could still have teams come over here and play, and it would work, and it would be expensive, but it could still work if the sponsorship money was found.
I don't think there's an equivalent in the sporting world for Sansa as an organisation, is there? I mean, I know you have things organised at the international level, and then you might come down to a regional level, say with, as in football, soccer, they have their confederations, Oceania, etc., Europe and stuff. But Sansar doesn't seem to fit the mould, because you'd think that it crosses too many air of geographical areas, if you like. You'd think the natural fit for South African rugby is within an African conference. The natural fit for Australia and New Zealand would be within Oceania, and for the Argentinians within South America. But this seems to be like imposed over the top of even those regional bodies.
The other thing is, and we know it's been out there, was South Africa's look to play in Europe. They wanted to join the Six Nations rather than play in the Tri Nations at one point. That was before it became the Rugby Championship and Argentina came in. Now, this again may open the door that South African teams could look to play in Europe, and that could solve their problem of losing players to European clubs. 75-plus players left South Africa at the end of the last Super Rugby season to go and play in Japan or Europe. So now, if you think if the Sharks, the Stormers and all of those teams suddenly could find a way to play in the European competitions, and there's only a one-hour time difference between the UK and South Africa, so it makes a lot of sense to just fly up there. They're on the same time zone as some of the countries in Europe. So again, there's not going to be that adjustment. It does make a lot of sense, and they may well make that decision. Now, it's probably not going to happen overnight. There would have to be a lot of rejigging in Europe to see how they could do it, but Europe may go for it. South Africa, I think, would love that to happen. But getting back to the Force, to me, it is ludicrous to get rid of the Force. If you look at it, and I've been promoting this for a while, to me, the best option for Australian rugby is to merge the Brumbies and the Rebels. If you look at the distance between Melbourne and Canberra, it makes sense. They could play four games in Melbourne, three games in Canberra. They have then a team that goes into two cities. They also have the opportunity then to get some crowds in Melbourne that the Brumbies struggle to get in Canberra. They're only averaging a crowd of 7,000. If you look, every team that plays in Canberra has to go there by bus because the air flights are not that good from Sydney and Melbourne, and certainly there's no direct flights. I think there's one direct flight from Perth a day. So that's an issue. It's cold. It's a miserable stadium. And to me, yes, they are a successful team. Maybe you've got to relocate the Brumbies to Melbourne. And the other question I say is, okay, everyone goes, the Rebels are privately owned. Well, why not give the ownership of the Brumbies to these guys, or maybe ask them to invest or a part share? Because then it eases the financial burden on the AIU that they have the Brumbies owned by a club. And who knows, the Brumbies might actually make some money playing in that situation. But the Force makes sense. If you want this to be respected and rugby union to be a national sport, you have to keep the team in Perth.
Well, you'd think so, but the judgment shown by some of the administrators in rugby in recent years would say that that's not going to happen. I mean, the people who've done this review that has led to this change in the Super Rugby structure, are these the same people that led the review into changing the Super Rugby structure in the first place? Where are the people responsible for making these decisions? Because let's face it, none of the problems being suffered by Super Rugby now were unforeseeable when these decisions were made. None of them. Everything that they're worried about now, they should have been worried about 2 or 3 years ago when they made the decision to expand.
Yeah, and look, I mean, I'm going to make myself maybe unpopular with some, and I know the reasons why we have Japan and the Sunwolves playing in this Super Rugby competition, because obviously they're hosting the World Cup. They want Japan to be competitive as hosts of the World Cup. But do they really belong here? And I don't think they do. It's ludicrous that you have the Japanese Sunwolves playing their games in Singapore. Singapore's not a rugby hotbed. And if you watch the crowds there, nobody's interested. And I've spoken to people from the Asian Rugby Federation, and they've said it's a disaster. Like, from the Sunwolves' perspective, it has not been good. They're losing money hand over fist. Sure, at the moment they're being propped up because they're hosting the World Cup, and they're kind of like a flag bearer for the World Cup. But it's not a good idea. Now, just moving the Sunwolves into Australia, is that going to solve the problem?
No. They'll still lose money hand over fist. And they would have known that when they set this expansion up. If they thought that they were just going to walk in and suddenly have piles of cash falling on them, they were kidding themselves. And I still don't understand why all of this happened to Super Rugby. Why is it that Argentina, for example, isn't spreading the rugby word in South America. Why aren't they being the flag bearers for South America in South America and encouraging the growth of the game there? Because if they keep flying out and playing in Australia and New Zealand, it's not doing anything for South American rugby at all. It's just making Argentina better and all the others are being left behind.
I think, to be fair, they are trying to do their bit and Uruguay is sort of coming up. But again, Argentina is the only place that has full-time professional players. You know, Uruguay, they had to pay their own way to play at the World Cup, all the players. So it shows the gulf between the two. And you have a very valid point. Somebody needs to be going in there to help those. To me, and I've been saying this for a very long time, and to be fair, Sanzar said this for a long time, that they were going to bring in the Pacific Island nations. But we all know the reason that they won't is because Tonga and Samoa and Fiji, if they start winning games in World Cups and prevent some of the big nations getting through to the quarterfinals, those teams then have to qualify for the next World Cup. And of course, they want to protect their interests. They don't want suddenly your Samoas and Tongas automatically qualifying because they've got through. So there's a lot of self-interest there, whereas there's not interest in what is best for the game globally, and certainly at the moment what is best for the game here in Australia and in the Southern Hemisphere.
Well, the idea that you just brought up then about, you know, what the reasons that the Pacific Islands are somewhat left behind by the rugby world would be poo-pooed by some, especially those in the positions to make those decisions. But you know what? It rings so true. And let's face it, as long as rugby continues to have that attitude about their sport, they will be a minnow internationally. And they are. They're a minnow international sport, rugby union. It's not played in that many countries at a competitive enough level to think that it's a major international sport. And it will continue to wallow in this post-colonial daydream that it's having.
Well, do you think we've done enough on that? Should we move to our guest for the show?
Should.
Hi, I'm Thomas the Hitman Hearn, and you are listening to Not the Foodie Show.
Well, as we said at the top of the podcast, our guest today is Greg Dyer, the former Australian cricket wicketkeeper. Now, the reason I wanted to speak to Greg Dyer, because I was looking at the test series in India and how Steve Smith was accused of cheating when he looked up at the dressing room to see whether he should refer a decision where he'd been given out. And it was blown up into a massive, massive issue, which he said obviously he had a brain fade on the pitch. Now, the sad thing was Greg Dyer, back in 1987, claimed a catch. Well, in fact, the interesting thing was he never actually appeals. If you watch it on YouTube, he does not appeal. But a catch was claimed by the Australian team. It was given out. Andrew Jones, the batsman for New Zealand, was given out. And if you remember, John, I don't know if you do, I was at the next test match, which I think was at the Wacker. And of course, Greg Dyer had taken the place of Tim Zura. And it was incredible. I've never seen anything like it. Here was a player representing Australia, and the crowd turned against him. There were banners that were Dyer, Dyer, liar, liar. And there was stuff like that. And I was thinking, how do you cope with that when you're an international sportsman and your own fans are abusing you? So I wanted to speak to Greg Dyer about that. And also the fact that, as I mentioned, soon after that incident, 2 months later, his test career was over after six test matches, and then his first class career was over within a year. Now, he said, "My life began when I finished cricket. I call my cricket life a former lifetime. Life's turned out okay, but I have absolutely no regrets or grudges. I'm certainly not bitter and twisted." Now, that shows great strength of character in my mind. But let's hear it from the man himself, Greg Dyer. Greg Dyer, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Thanks, Ashley. It's good to be with you.
No, it's good to catch up. Now, I wanted to look back on, obviously, your career and the finishing of your career. But first of all, we're not too far off being the same age. And I'm thinking that you would have been brought up with the same sort of traditional values that probably I was, where integrity, honesty and doing right by others. Would that be right?
Absolutely. Integrity is my favourite word.
That's good to hear. Now, was it always your dream to play for Australia growing up?
Oh, I think it was my wildest dream to play for Australia, frankly. You know, it's not something that you ever think you could possibly, you know, really aspire to. It's something that was just a, as I say, a wild dream, but it was certainly that, and it was something that really an amazing achievement, I suppose. I look back and think, albeit that I'm a pretty small player in the greater scheme of Australian cricket, but an incredible thing that happened to me.
One of the things I find incredible is that, you know, I read growing up you were a fast bowler and not a wicketkeeper, and your journey to wicketkeeping was just because you were pretty much the only guy that put his hand up and realised he was going to get a game.
Yeah, I'd played cricket every day of every summer since I was 8 years old, and went to a great cricket club age 15, I think it was, something like 14 or 15, and they told me that there was a prospect I wouldn't play every week because there were too many guys in the fourth grade squad. And I thought, well, hang on, no wicketkeeper. If I play wicketkeeper, well, at least they've got to have one of them every week. So I put my hand up, and I guess the rest is history, as they say.
Now, there is an old adage that wicketkeepers are born, that you can't create them. Do you think when you took the gloves it felt very natural?
Yes, absolutely. So that is certainly my premise, that you can't make a wicketkeeper. You either are one or you're not. So it turned out that I was one.
Now, you made it into the Australian team in 1986, playing some one-day internationals in India as a backup to Tim Zura, and you were obviously in the dressing room for that famous Madras tied test. You know, how tough is India? We've obviously just had the series there, which was an amazing series, but how tough is it to play in India?
Well, that particular game in as a case in point, you know, the weather was diabolical. We were playing at the wrong time of year, and it was just so hot and humid. You just could cut the air with a knife, and the sort of concept of a warm up was quite ridiculous, frankly. I was in the change room in a support squad for Dean Jones as he was going about accumulating his 200 runs. It was as close to, well, as I say, I've not been in a theatre of war, but it's the closest thing I've seen to an incredible act of bravery for him to continue on in the circumstances, and he made that 200 and then went straight to hospital. So it was a pretty amazing thing. It was the conditions weather-wise were very difficult. I think conditions off the field were sort of passable, but certainly better than they'd been, you know, sort of 15, 20 years before that. And I think, frankly, conditions off the field have improved dramatically in the 15 or 20 years since I played as well. So it's an easier tour now, I'm sure, and I don't think the weather is quite so bad at this time of year as it was when we were there. So, not quite so bad, thankfully.
No, exactly. Now, a lot of people may forget that you were part of the 1987 World Cup winning team, which was a moment that a lot of cricket sort of followers feel was a watershed moment for Australian cricket. Did you feel at that point that was almost when you'd sort of established yourself in the Australian setup?
Well, we went to the World Cup that year as probably, and remembering that there were only eight teams invited to play in the World Cup back then, we probably went to that World Cup as sort of ranked either seven or even potentially eight. Maybe we were ranked in front of Zimbabwe, to be fair, but we were way down the pecking order in terms of who the general public might have thought had a good chance to win. And the thing was, we went through that tournament and we accumulated real momentum and we started winning close games. We won a game in Madras, in fact, against India by a run. And consequently, really the momentum grew and grew and grew, and we ended up absolutely certain by the time we got to semi-finals and the final that we were going to win. And a lot of that was frankly off the back of pinching more singles. Bob Simpson, the manager, was very strong with the guys that the team that runs the most singles will win, but also the best fielding team. And I think it's fair to say that we had a fielding squad and we worked harder at our fielding drills and what have you than any other team there, and we were the best fielding side. And of course, you know, I look back and think, well, the wicketkeeper's pretty central to the way in which a team fields and calls a lot of the shots out there. And so it's a very proud moment for me that, you know, I was part of a World Cup winning team that won off the back of, you know, running hard the singles, but also being the best fielding side there. So really proud moment for me, obviously, a highlight of my international career. And yeah, you would have thought that I might have hung in a bit longer as the result, you know, as the renaissance of Australian cricket was born in that tournament. You would have thought that the majority of the guys would have stuck around for a while, but not to be.
But I'm thinking if that was the highlight, I'm thinking the Boxing Day Test match in 87, you're 28 years old, it's your fourth Test match, and the catch off Andrew Jones was probably the low light. Is that fair to say?
Well, not really, you know, because it's a tiny, tiny moment in time. I've no regrets whatsoever about what happened that day. I've regrets about what happened afterwards, and the way that it was managed and handled, I think, was very poor. And but you know, it was a thing that happens in a nanosecond on a cricket field over the length of you know, a career and a lifetime, and it's not something that troubles me greatly. You know, as I say, it's just something that happened. It to some extent didn't help my longevity in the game, but you know, that's just the way it was. It's fate.
I've watched the clip since because I knew we were going to speak. And to be fair to you, you don't actually appeal when you because you look like you're not sure whether it has carried and how it ended up in your gloves.
Indeed, it was exactly what happened. I didn't appeal because I tumbled over. The ball. I hit my left glove and I came up with it in my right. And I'm thinking, I'm not sure how that happened. Or I'm not sure what's gone on here, and you know, the replay shows that all it happened sort of under my midriff as I was spearing off to down leg side to try and take the catch. So you know, it wasn't something that bounced in. It wasn't like the ball bounced in front of me in my eye line. It all happened in a split second underneath me, and I wasn't sure what happened. I wished that I'd been given the opportunity to explain that to the cricket world on that afternoon. You know, I'd have come across, I think, as reasonably articulate, and apologetic about what had occurred, and you know, able to explain the fact that it was just a moment on a cricket field that I wish hadn't occurred, but you know, who's to blame?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing I feel incredibly sorry for you. We've obviously seen Stephen Smith was accused of looking to the dressing room for a referral in the recent series, and obviously because he's captain, he was able to face the media and describe it as a brain fade. But it must have been soul-destroying that you couldn't defend yourself.
Yeah, it was a funny old set. I said, listen, I want to go into the New Zealand change room and talk to Andrew to start with, and I wasn't allowed to do that. And I said, I really want to talk to the press and tell them my side of it. And I guess at that stage, though, I wasn't really aware of how it was going to blow up, and it sort of blew up the next morning in the newspapers, and particularly the New Zealand press. So that was a shame. I wasn't allowed to sort of put my side of the story until the very last day of the game, when frankly the big story was Mike Whitney holding out for a draw and Australia winning the trophy, the series trophy, and nobody really really wanted to pay any attention to what I had to say by that stage, and that the newspapers had been published and the story had blown, you know. It was Trevor Chappell Under Arm Mark II.
Yeah, I mean, I remember it vividly. And the thing that I find incredible as well is that the sort of abuse that you copped. Now, we have teams, have sport team psychologists now, etc. I mean, I'm thinking back then there was none of that. But was there any support for you? Because obviously, even the Australian crowd went against you. And I'm thinking it must have been an incredibly lonely journey out to the middle of the wicket and a pretty tough time.
Yeah, it was, and as you pointed out at the beginning of this interview, integrity is really important to me. That's who I am as an individual. It is a very important thing. I don't ever want to feel like my integrity is in question. It's sort of who I am and what I feel is most important in life. So it was a very difficult time, as I recall. And no, there was no support, psychologist or otherwise, really for what was going on. And, you know, you just got on with it, frankly. So, and again, you know, that's no big deal. It was the way it was. And, you know, I'm not bitter and twisted about any of that. I've moved well and truly moved on. The most important thing for me, frankly, is that people who know me, both within the game and outside of it, people who have, you know, given the incident more than, you know, 30 seconds of thought, there's nobody there that would ever, you know, question, you know, my actions or integrity over the matter. And, you know, people who know me understand what occurred, and that's probably the most important thing to me, frankly.
Yeah, you touched on how your career was sort of maybe brought to a quicker close. I mean, it was 2 months later, your test career was over after 6 tests, all of them wins, we must add, and you were replaced by Ian Healy. And then a year later, your first-class career was over. I mean, that was a very, very rapid decline. And were you ready to walk away at that time?
No, I was not. I think to some extent I'd been weakened. It was sort of the law of the jungle, and I was a weakened animal, and so a fairly easy target, I suppose, for people. So, but you know, the way I look at all that, I'm quite philosophical. In many respects, I've been really quite lucky that's what happened, because you know, it gave me time for another life, if you like, another life and another career in, you know, a different direction, and that's been, you know, that's been quite fortuitous. So I have no qualms about what happened with any of that, I've got to say, and you know, in the end it all turned out quite positive. But I do recall, you know, the day that I heard the news that I'd been that I wasn't being invited to play in the next game for New South Wales, to put it in the opposite language. That was a tough moment for me. That was the moment that I realised I'm no longer, you know, a first-class cricketer, and that was a moment. I struggled through that.
Yeah, well, there was a quote that you gave to Malcolm Knox in his book, The Keepers. If I can just read it to you. You said, "The fall felt dramatic. The day I became an ex-cricketer was a horrible day, but I was a minor player. I can't imagine what it's like for the really significant players who've had to wake up one day and no longer be the thing that has defined them." Now, I find that really, really strong comment, but I also happened to read, just after I read that, Andre Agassi say, "One day your whole life comes to an end. It's a kind of death." Now, I mean, that's obviously taking it to an extreme, but he was an elite athlete all on his own. I mean, do we do anything to help counsel players when the end comes?
I think these days we do a better job of it. And, you know, I know we've not talked about this in this interview previously, but I'm president of the Australian Cricketers Association these days, and I'm very proud of the efforts that the ACA, in conjunction with Cricket Australia, to be absolutely fair and open, that we make in terms of preparing players a little better than we did. But it's still, you know, at the end, it still is a very, very difficult process, and I can understand where Agassi is coming from in his choice of language. It's something that you can never be, frankly, you can never be fully prepared for. I use the language, in fact, that I was a test cricketer in a former lifetime. So it's interesting that Agassi uses the language in a probably a more negative connotation than what I do, but it still feels like that was a different person and a different life. You know, you just have to, you do have to sort of start again in many, many respects. I think we do a better job of preparing the guys almost from their rookie year within the game through the course of their career in making sure that they've at least got another activity that they're preparing themselves for, or something else that they're studying, or you know, some experience, work experience that they're taking, and we try and make sure that they have some balance away from the game in, as I say, those early years, and hopefully it sets them up and gives them some thinking about what they might do after cricket.
Yeah, it was interesting because you also said my life began when I finished cricket, which is also going back to this interview that I saw with Agassi. He said, I spent a third of my life not preparing for the next two thirds, which is pretty much what you've just alluded to there, that now there is more concentration on trying to prepare those guys for the life after international sport.
Yes, I think we are much more conscious of it, but inevitably, though, it's still a very difficult period for people to transition. Ironically, I suppose the T20 format is now a format that people allows, you know, the guys to stay on and play a bit longer, and you know, still enjoy, you know, time in the sun, so to speak, notwithstanding that it's not 100% of their time and what have you. And you know, obviously, you know, the financial rewards are there for longer, and they kind of soften the blow to some extent as well. That the guys that do well in the game do well financially from the game, and I think that's absolutely right and proper, and will help, you know, as I say, soften the blow, soften the transition process somewhat, which is a good thing.
But some of them, as you would well know, it's not about the money, is it? It's a bit more than that. It's about being in the limelight. It's also about loving the game. Now, I've interviewed many athletes who've made it to the top and some who haven't, and some have said they still love playing, that's why they're dedicated. Others, though, have said it's just a job. And I sort of worry about those who felt, you know, when they finish, it's a very different feeling.
I think that's quite sad that people are feeling like it's, you know, just a day at the office kind of thing, turning out for your country or for your state or whatever. I think that's quite a sad and sorry state of affairs. If you've lost the passion for the game, you know, I think, well, like anything, frankly, if it's just a job, then go and do something else that you're feeling more passionate about. You've got to have passion in anything that you're doing, whether it's sport or a regular job. What you do, Ashley, you know, you've got to feel passionate about it. Otherwise, go and find something else to do.
I couldn't agree with you more on that one. I mean, we have seen, obviously, in some of the elite clubs around the world in various sports, where the clubs protect players who may have crossed the line and done a few things wrong. Do you think that is wrong as well? Because when they leave, they don't kind of know that they are not meant to do that, if that makes sense?
Yeah, okay. I'm not sure we'd accuse cricket as a sport of that, though, would we?
No, I'm not referring to cricket in this case, no.
Yeah, and so then I'll be critical of those organisations that do that. I think it's not setting people up for the real world, and not, you know, sport should reflect society, and vice versa to some extent, and that's not a trait that we want in society, that people aren't responsible for their actions and so forth. It's not, for me, it's not so much about being a role model, although of course to some extent that's important. It's just being a good member of society, frankly. And you know, if your behaviours are condoned, if poor behaviour is condoned, then that's a very bad thing.
Is there a brotherhood amongst, you know, former cricketers where if someone is struggling, they will all sort of band together and try and help that guy or even now female out?
God, I hope so. I really do hope so. I think cricket as a sport isn't necessarily as good at that as it needs to be, and I think we can spend more time making sure that the networks operate and are effective. As president of the ACA, my worst nightmare is that we get some tragic news about a colleague and nobody is expecting it, and it's a shock to everybody. That's my worst nightmare, and we need to really work harder at those networks and making sure that people feel connected and we reach out to each other on a regular basis to make sure that we're all okay. It's a really important thing that we have to do. As I say, I'm not sure that cricket is as good at it, certainly not in this country anyway, as we could be and should be. So it's a focus for me that we strengthen those networks.
Was there anyone that was there for you? I mean, I'm sure your wife probably was.
Of course. You mean at the, you know, when the axe fell, is that?
Absolutely, yeah.
There were people who were incredibly supportive of me. Yeah, my mates and the guys that I was closest to were as shocked as I was, frankly, when it all happened, and were very, very supportive. But sometimes awkward in terms of what do you say and what don't you say. It's almost, there was a grieving process to go through, and you know, that's sometimes an awkward thing for people to watch.
I'm sure it was. Look, Greg Dyer, it's been wonderful catching up with you, and thank you very much for being so open and honest with us looking back on your career.
That's fine, actually. As I say, a long time ago, and with perhaps, I think, spent too much time talking about some of those negative things, because I played cricket because I loved it. I was so passionate about it, and a couple of incidents and the end coming in the way that it did, I don't think properly represent the time that I had in cricket, and my love and passion for it are undiminished as the result. So there you go.
Thanks again, Greg.
All right, Ashley.
Hi, this is Ian Healy, and you're listening to This Is Not The Footy Show.
John, you're an evil man. Ian Healy, the man who replaces Greg Dyer, and you play that sting.
Oh, well, Ian Healy has his own unique story to tell coming into the Australian team, and I don't think him going out and the other one coming in had anything to do with each other, really.
Well, here's a good trivia question for you. When I was reading that book by Malcolm Knox, can you name the three wicketkeepers, only three, ever kept wicket to Shane Warne in Test cricket?
Well, one's Ian Healy.
Yeah.
The other's, of course, Adam Gilchrist. And the other one would be Greg Dyer.
No.
It's
a great trivia question.
Oh, it's not Justin Langer, is it?
No. Phil Emery.
Oh, okay. Yep, New South Wales keeper.
Anyway, I want to now, as my topic on the show this time, I want to just talk about something there that we alluded to in the interview with Greg Dyer, and that is whether modern-day athletes are protected too much by the sporting organisations that they represent. Now, we've seen cases, John, where players it's been kind of hushed up if they've been involved in a not too good incident, let's say it. Some of them have been alcoholic incidents. We've even seen players who've tested positive for drugs. That's been hushed up in the past by certain organisations. And of course, if you look back at the Olympic Games, we had nine Australian athletes tamper with their accreditation to get in to watch the men's basketball semi-final against Serbia. The Australian Boomers were playing in that game. They were all caught, they were all arrested, and then, and this is an example I got, I only found this out recently, that the fine was, I think it was 10,000 reals each, which works out to about 4,000 Australian dollars for them to get their passports back. Now, apparently the Australian Olympic Committee paid those fines to get the passports back for the players, or sorry, the athletes, but so the taxpayer basically paid that. So they broke the rules, they tampered with their accreditation. Yes, they spent one night in a jail, but surely they should again face the consequences for what they did. And instead, the AOC has picked up the tab. Now, to me, this is where we've got it all horribly, horribly wrong. And I know Olympic athletes, a lot of them don't get paid the equivalent, as we're talking, of some of the top athletes in other sporting codes. But I just think this is some of the reason we have athletes, when they retire, struggling to acclimatise in the real world, because they're not aware that their actions are unacceptable in the real world, because the organisations that they represent protect them or pick up the fine for them and whatever, and don't actually smack them over the head and go, that's out of order, you're responsible for this, you're going to have to pay the consequences.
Good points. I think we've got to remember that the modern athlete didn't invent bad behaviour.
Absolutely
and
not.
That this stuff has been going on humanity for a long, long time, and people who've always been foisted above being ordinary, so to speak, have always had those potential pitfalls in front of them. Now, you can have a failure of behaviour. You might go out, have a few drinks, do something really dumb. You can also have failure of character. Now, sports, I think, get confused about which is which and panic because of that. So, you know, when someone goes out and gets really drunk and does something stupid, their immediate reaction is, oh, how is everybody else going to view this? Not how we view it, you know, we might not care, but our reaction has to be for how it's viewed by everybody outside. So suddenly something that is not really an issue has to be addressed and treated as a big issue. Okay, so athletes and people get used to their behaviour being exonerated or excused, if you like.
Now, I'll throw another one in there, John, in that, you know, I've been involved in the media now for sadly 30 years, showing my age. But the one thing I've noticed in all of that time is how the media has changed beyond belief. Now, years ago, as you say, when the media coverage, there wasn't anything like Facebook, there wasn't Twitter, there wasn't all this social media stuff. But there were relationships between journalists and sporting clubs. Now, there might be an incident, and one that springs to mind was a player, footballer, punched a guy in a bar. Now, you know, today, that would be a massive, massive thing. It turned out that it never actually went to court, because all the witnesses said this guy who got punched was the one who started it. He threw beer over the player. He was abusing his girlfriend. No one condones that the guy hit the other, the footballer hit the other guy. But I think in those days, people would put themselves in that position and go, well, hang on a sec. You know, what would you do in that situation if someone is abusing your partner? You either walk away, some people don't, and will stand there and just go bing, you know. Now, I'm not saying that's the right thing to do at all, but in those days, rather than suddenly just going, this guy's hit a guy, it's outrageous, he's a top athlete, people looked at what happened before they reported it and tried to get to the bottom of it or get the facts. Whereas now what we see is it just goes blur. Nobody thinks before they write or before they start commenting on it. And I think that that again is exacerbated the situation. But I do think that in a lot of these cases, the clubs or the organising bodies need to put responsibility on some of these guys and girls.
You're right. Outrage is the new black. And people just make comment about things that they don't know or understand anything about. Okay, and that's going to be the way of the modern world for a little while yet, and we're going to have to get used to it. What people, we're confused between...
Do we have to get used to it, or do we need to actually train our brains to work out which people are responsible and don't go out there and just regurgitate what they've heard? They actually find out the facts before they report it. There are organisations out there that will do that, I think we need to just be more discerning where we get our information.
Having an organisation that does do that isn't going to stop the organisations that don't do that.
Very true, but that's why I say we need to be more discerning as to where we get our information.
Oh, we need to be more discerning about the vegetables we eat too, but if you look at the profit of McDonald's, that isn't happening. I mean, so sporting organisations are caught between this fear of being, of fear essentially, a fear of outrage, that they're going to have to cover up things that they don't really have to cover up, so they cover up things that they shouldn't. Oh, it's a crazy, confused world, right?
Well, you just confused me.
Oh, I did. Look, one thing you can't really stand is violence. Okay, if a player goes out and gets drunk and whacks someone, then they should get the same penalty as anybody else who goes out and whacks someone. And the court of law should deal with that.
Agreed.
Now, we have seen cases where perhaps profile has meant that someone might perhaps get a less of a sentence than someone who doesn't have a profile, which I don't believe in. You should be judged equally regardless of what you do outside of the court of law. You're there because of whatever behaviour sent you there. Okay? Now, at the other side of that is that those players shouldn't be punished by the organisation they happen to play for. As a fan, if Bill Bloggs goes and does something stupid and ends up getting locked up for 6 months, that's a bit of tough luck for Bill. It's going to be tough luck for us because he's not going to be there to be playing for us. But once he's done his 6 months, that's it. Society has decided that 6 months is what he should do for that crime. It's not up to sporting organisations and bodies to suddenly become moral arbiters about what's a proper and right punishment. We have courts of law for that. And that's where sports clubs, and I think, sometimes get caught up. You know, because all it ever is from their side is reactive. They're only ever reactive to these things, never proactive.
I think you've summed it up very well. And as we had a rather long interview with Greg Dyer, we're probably going to call it quits there for this podcast. But if you've got thoughts on that, share them with us on Facebook or share them with us at notthefootyshow.com. We'd love to hear from you.
See you, Ash.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next week.